On this week's show, the dorks do the news.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right, we're back, and y'all might notice this looks or sounds a little different than usual. And we're going to call it the mashup right now. And I'm bringing on, if you don't know, there's this little show called The Dorks Cast. It's not really that small, so I shouldn't call it a little show. But there's this show we have called The Dork Cast, and the construction dorks, that is. And the gentleman sat down with me today to do the news on the crew. We're going to have a little fun. So I have Jonathan Marsh, Trent Leinenbach, and Travis Voss with me today. Those are the voices you'll hear. Jonathan, say hello.
Hey, guys.
he asked me
because I'm the person that goes, I'm gonna reach for my coffee right now, and as I'm bringing the coffee to my mouth, Jeff is going to call on me. That's how this works, right?
So if you thought this was going to go a little different than usual, well, you're right. So I hope you're driving fast and taking chances while you listen in. Trent Leinenbach, say hello, buddy.
Hey, how's it going, everybody? It's definitely been a minute since I've done a crossover with the crew. So a lot of fun.
Yeah. Not like any of these voices should be unfamiliar, but maybe not all together. And last, but certainly not least, Travis Voss.
Certainly not least. Hey there, everybody. How's it going?
Well, listen, we're going to dive in. We're going to have a whole lot of fun, but this is just going to be a news episode. So if you were looking for me to interview these three, well, you're going to have to look longer because that's going to take a little while longer. We'll get back to that. Are you trying to reach the innovators and decision makers in construction technology? Then look no further than sponsoring the ConTech Crew. That's right, we're taking new advertisers. Email us at advertising@theconTechCrew.com to learn more. All right, so construction technology news of the week. With the dorks, it is. We're going to do three articles. We kind of agreed upon them as a group, but Jonathan, I'm going to let you kick us off with what do you got for us today?
Well, I think we're going to kick you off with one that talks just a little bit about SaaS, you know, so software as a subscription. And for the first time in years and years, those numbers of subscriptions per person or per business are starting to go down. We actually saw between 2023 and 2024, a 14% drop in the number. Now, this is the number of SaaS applications that are being used within IT departments, you know, sort of across the U.S. It's a study that's been done a couple times now. They're saying it's the oldest study, but it hasn't been done that long. So you know what I mean? Like in tech, when they say it's the oldest, it could be like 3 weeks old. But I thought it was interesting because more and more when I'm talking to people, Jeff, I hear complaints about this model, about the way, and it's not just from people using it, it's also from the software providers saying, we're really having a tough time, you know, balancing the subscription costs along with what we really need to develop this product. So I thought I'd bring it up. It does a nice job of sort of walking through some of the pros and cons and talking about how it could be better. But the most important thing is they have this state of SaaS report that they're sort of putting up there that digs down into the numbers a little bit and talks about how the market's been changing and sort of whether or not, you know, it is the way that software should be done. Because I don't know about you, but I actually dug buying my software.
I mean, we can all actually talk pretty extensively about this and to give an understanding, like in the old days, you sold a product, right? It was off the shelf. You bought it. It was in and there was maintenance, right? And that maintenance went into the bug fixes and other things. And then if you wanted to, you know, improve the product, those improvements were usually part of some new module that you would sell and then add that into the maintenance cost. And it allowed for a true maintenance. And I think every innovation has a little bit of a byproduct that you don't see coming. And SaaS is software as a service. So you're literally paying to use the software consistently, which was supposed to reduce your total overhead costs, your maintenance costs, any of the upkeep of internal IT that then that could be offset and pay for the product itself. But unfortunately, I think, and I'll be interested, Trent, with what you're doing and Travis with what you're doing right now, it also kind of drove for continuous innovation or adding new things to keep people happy. And it got away from the maintenance of the product. And I think we've seen some, I don't know if I want to call it scope creep, as it were. And I think this is some right sizing from scope creep too. So Travis, I'm interested.
I think the big change that you really saw was when the software especially became web-based, because you were no longer shipping out DVDs or flash drives or anything with. So releasing software became really, really easy. So I think that was like you kind of you were saying, like it balanced out this fact that, hey, we can release pretty much on demand all the time, all these bug fixes, all these updates. So I think the software industry probably took on some of that as this is a benefit to you. You're paying for this within a subscription. But I think that, like you're saying, that it did end up into a lot of scope creep because I think the customers kind of got used to that too. It's like, you mean I can fix this button in my software right now, or I can have this feature built out and it's released immediately? I can see that pressure being put on those software companies to do that kind of stuff. Trent, are you seeing it from your side?
Yeah. And I mean, look, there's just been an evolution in the way software is deployed. And even the way it's utilized, I mean, like you said, so much is web-based now. And you know, a lot of what we do at Stratus, like we're in a collaborative environment where we're even talking about, you know, we're deploying across, you know, large companies and individual users that are pushing work to a common environment. And I mean, so, you know, it makes sense for us to follow that model because, you know, we can charge a subscription fee and I mean, there's costs involved in that. And we're continually updating like the same environment for maybe 50, 100 or 150 users within that environment without like taxing their internal teams to deploy that fix to, you know, 50, 100 or 150 individual users. So it's, you know, it's a different model. And I mean, it's obviously become very popular, but I think there are a lot of minds out there that are still kind of in that like a la carte, you know, methodology. Like, you know, maybe I don't want somebody to spend my money for me. And there's nothing wrong right with that. But I mean, you know, definitely if you're in a subscription base, I mean, you can, nothing says you can't kind of, you know, have an inquisition or you know, question that company a little bit about what they're getting for that. I mean, I would advise it. I mean, you know, we do customer roadmap meetings and, you know, we talk about things that are, I mean, there is some transparency to it, but people want to know what they're paying for. And I think there's just a different way you're paying for it in the SaaS method versus, you know, individual deployment or the way of old where you might've got a disc. Maybe you had a disc.
Well, I kind of wonder. Know, I wonder if it changed the mindset. I think that the consumers even got used to it because I think that, especially from a contracting side, like we'll just take BIM for a while or CAD. There was people that would use that perpetual license of CAD for 10 years because it worked.
Mm-hmm, sure,
but then they started getting used to having a you know, what is it, if we're talking to Autodesk, you have 3 years window to use the software and then you're forced to upgrade. And I wonder if that started to change the mindset. Like they're used to getting forced all these new features and updates and that's just become what they come accustomed to. John, you were going to say something.
I was going to say that I don't think it's the same for all. Like for Stratus, for things that deploy the web app, I totally understand the SaaS model. But for everything else, it feels like you're throwing out my tools ahead of time. Like I got a tool, I get it set up to do a job. It does that job. It does it effectively. And then you basically come along and say, that's cool, we'll give you the new tool. But in order to get the new tool, you got to throw out your old tool. And that's where I'm getting frustrated, is because, you know, like it used to be, I'm going to pick on, what is it? Qubit doesn't exist anymore. So I can pick at it, pick on them. They used to have this little key, and all it did is it registered point clouds really well. So they went into every environment correctly. Re-registered them in a unique way that's still even not done now, but easier, even easier than what's done now. So like I actually held on to my hardware key from Qubit well into the time when the company no longer exists, because I had a tool that worked that did my job. And I think that's the problem is, you know, you get into a subscription system. It's like, yes, we're going to give you the new tool. And yes, it can do more jobs, but you don't have something set up to do it. Like, I mean, in my shop, I have five grinders. I don't want one grinder that can do five things. I want five grinders so I can set them up to do different things. And that's what they do. And so I think there's a mindset that there's room for both, but I can see why everything going SaaS isn't necessarily the right move. You know?
I think you need to ask a question internally, like what's the, I mean, there's different types of software that we deploy in an organization. I mean, am I solving a point solution for one particular end user? Or is this like a company-wide, you know, is this a system that's deployed company-wide in a common methodology to everyone in my organization? I mean, there's different methods, and I think it should affect the way you look at how you should prefer paying for that software.
Well, but I will take this fun contrarian view, because I actually came from the days of selling and installing an on-prem system and then charging maintenance for it. And all we heard from our customers was, what are we paying you all this money for if it already runs? And it's like, okay, but you do realize that like your operating systems are getting patched every day. The SQL backend's getting patched
every day. They don't realize
that.
That's the thing.
No, they don't. And the framework's getting patched every day. And you expect that this stuff's just going to work as you update those things. And we're working to update those things. That's why we're charging you this maintenance fee. So that's why when the original SaaS stuff came out, we were like, oh, cool. We can take all that on ourselves and control as those things change and control how we update and roll them in. And we can just charge you and go this way. And so it's really funny because I actually have predicted this for a while. And how many places have all three of you been where some of the biggest conversations in leadership is the current cost of SaaS software and your licensing, which actually goes back to this article where I think this is cool, because I think this is where people have realized that there is a factor for consolidation. There's an opportunity to dig into the further the products that they have and how much they've changed. That was the other thing, is like you used to buy a software and it didn't change that much. Now it changes leaps and bounds and probably can push other things out the door and you can consolidate, which is what I think you see here. And I'm just going to tease this for some other later thing, but I think the same thing's coming when it comes to AI. And I think we have a big bill to pay. I think it's going to make this SaaS thing, like where we're all talking about, I wish we were back at them good old SaaS days. So just a theory.
Yeah. I mean, ahead. And what this article is talking, I mean, this is all SaaS, right? We're not just keyed in on one industry here. Right?
No, this is all SaaS. Right. Yeah, this is all not, SaaS. Not industry specific.
Look, we're pulling back from SaaS company development. I mean, you know, everything normalizes at some point, but I mean, I think a little bit of that rollback might just be, there's a lot of new products that hit the market and a lot of people were dabbling in new ones, and maybe they brought on two or three to try out to solve a problem, and they've now peeled it back to one. And I mean,
yeah, I think you're probably seeing a lot of companies looking at that cost that are digging into their shadow IT as well.
Yeah.
Yep.
And this, especially in our industry, specifically people will install those softwares without even addressing IT.
Yep. Yeah, I think you're right. And Trent, you're probably right. It is part of the natural curve too, as well. And it's good to see it.
It's coming shrink for back AI. Up. Trust me. It's coming.
Oh yeah. we can have a whole conversation about that. Well, so what should we jump into next?
Why don't we do an easy one? We'll do, should we tax robots? That would be fun. No one's going to have an opinion on that.
Are you actually taxing the robot, or are you taxing the robot?
I'm all for taxing robots.
Yeah.
We can tax the robots.
Okay,
tax them to death.
Let's read the actual article. So how U.S. manufacturers could benefit from a robot tax. And what they're talking about, what they're actually referring to a bunch of different ideas that got thrown out there. But the biggest idea would definitely be from Bill Gates when he really talked about putting in place a robot tax. And his primary purpose in it was to generate revenue for the government, because believe it or not, like individuals are less good at doing tax their own taxes than companies. So if everything's passing up to the company, that they don't see the taxes they're looking for, but also to maintain employment. And I wanted to add, I think the reason I was looking at it in general is because as you remove people from an industry and replace them with robots, you have a bunch of other effects that happen, right? And in this case, we've removed enough people and replaced them with robots in certain industries that, you know, those geographies that brought that business in with tax incentives and everything else, did they really, are they now looking and going, wait, the way this is set up, you're actually paying no taxes. And, you know, we have a bunch of basically civilization that has to go on around your business that was counting on the money that we thought you were going to make, you know? So what do you think? By the way, I could be very negative on this. I'm just being, I'm going to be pro taxes today. It will be fun.
That's an interesting stance.
Being pro tax, huh? Well, Trent, I feel like you're dying to jump in here, because if John's pro tax, what are you today?
Well, I am never pro tax, but I think a lot of this is, I don't think we understand the second and third effects of any of this yet. So I feel like a lot of what we're talking about here is it's simple economics. I mean, if workers are going to get pushed out, right, and there's going to be robots taking the place of a laborer or some form of tax paying individual in the workforce, then, you know, there's going to be economists out there who are trying to rationalize, what do you do with that loss of income to the federal government, I guess. So that would be my guess as to what they're really looking to do. I don't think this is in any way talking about a way, as much as I would love to believe it's a way that they're trying to, like, maybe semi punish a business for doing away with hiring people. I really think it's more about, how do we continue to feed this self-feeding entity of federal government that we've built? So you can get me down that rant, but
that's interesting, because that's interesting. I didn't really think of it that way. I didn't really think of the loss of revenue, and you're
probably making it.
Yeah. Cause I was going to be, I'm not hardline anti-tax. I just, not to continue to bash the federal government. I just know that most taxes collected never really end up where they're intended for. And a lot of this article talks about additional training, other incentives for workers, other incentives for the business to upskill their employees and stuff like that. And it's just, I wonder, you know, is there going to be another giant bureaucratic government office spun up, supposed to be counting these pennies to make sure they go to that? And how much is that overhead expense going to take? I mean, it's just, again, tinfoil hat, not being a big conspiracist or anything like that. It never ends up where it's intended. And like Trent was saying, you don't know what the follow on, the unintended consequences are going to be in something like this.
Back in 2020, I heard about a new software platform called Join. Within minutes of seeing Join, I knew it had the power to revolutionize collaborative project delivery. Join is now used by 50% of the ENR top 30. Why? Pre-con and ops leaders at DPR, Bolt, McCarthy, Barton Mallow, Clark, and others say that they like Join because it does two big things: collaborative, trackable decision-making, and awesomely simple visuals. Want to learn more about the power of Join? Go to www.join.build/demo to learn about how better gets built. Yeah, it's interesting. There's a couple of things in there that they call out that I think would be somewhat interesting, but also somewhat detrimental. You know, I think I've said this on stage quite a few times. It's like, definition of a robot is pretty loose. We call a lot of things robots that I wouldn't necessarily consider,
including things that are operated by human beings, right? So,
well, that's what I mean. Like, not to call them out, but the Mule, which is construction robotics, they have a robot that basically lifts CMU for you. It's not really a robot; it's just a machine. Right, like this is a tool. It doesn't actually, you do it yourself with your hands, so you're operating it. It's like, and so I'm a little worried that the definition could then, and like you said, Travis, then we're gonna have to hire a whole bunch of people to come in and go like, well, it has 9 articulating sections and it does these things on its own, so it's a robot. It's not a robot. Oh God, I don't need it. Also, I want to argue people are really not losing jobs to robots, and we consistently haven't over the years. We've always said we're going to, and it really has not come to fruition. There has always been a subset of labor that has been lost in certain areas, but ultimately those were never really the jobs that had satisfaction or that you could fill people, right? It was pretty much a rotating spot that people were moving out of as fast as they could get into it. So a little bit of that, but I also feel like upskilling is a huge thing, right? It's one thing we haven't done enough of in our country, at least, is upskill workers as part of this process. And how do you fund that? Who does that land on? That is interesting.
Well, I think this hits a couple new notes with the AI coming into the scene, because we'll be able to displace an entirely new set of people. Now I didn't say get rid of, I did say displace, and I agree with that. And Trent, to your point, actually, in theory, if they're getting robots to increase revenues and they're paying taxes on their revenues, we should still see the tax money anyways. Shouldn't matter if it's robots or people. I think the bigger problem is what a person does for a community is totally different than what a robot does for a community. And are your communities going to survive full automation? And then yes, if we are 100% capitalist and it is all about the money, then be damned to culture until you don't have a workforce left that's not, robots. But like, I don't think that's the case. I think that we have something, and I think this is a good point, is at least saying, here's areas where we can agree that we've displaced a workforce, and right now we need tax revenues based on that workforce. So what are we going to do? Or the culture of that workforce not being there now costs this area more money, And I think about like Travis, if you don't have a job in your community, yes, you don't get your job and you don't pay your taxes, but the kids also don't get a coach. And there's like a bunch of these, their volunteer fire department loses a person. There is this idea that sort of is going directly against the robots that just says, hey, people and robots are not interchangeable. So if you interchange people with robots, we have to address all the other changes that sort of are lumped into that as we're doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. You're taking the person out of the job, but also the community. And that has a lot of other effects.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you can upskill them, right, and you can focus on that, which is a lot of what we have to do, then you can... they can drive more. They can be more available. If we can do things better.
It has a limit, though. I mean, got to be real about this. It's if enough individual contributors get displaced from automation or any type of, there is a level of upskill that can happen, and we should always look at that. But as those contributors leave the market, there's going to be less need for the people managing and the people that you're those upskilled positions. There is a real threat here. I know we haven't seen it yet. But there's likely to be people leaving the employment, the job market because of some of this stuff at some point. So, my theory is they're a little concerned about where that taxpayer, Jonathan, yeah, to your point, revenue increases, they're going to get more tax dollars from the business. That's all fine. But you're talking about entire employees leaving the market that are now no longer paying federal income tax, but are now possibly even getting onto some kind of universal basic income or welfare. So it's almost a complete flip. It is a dangerous slope. I think people are wondering what's going to happen there. And I think that's what they're worried about.
The restaurants that used to sit outside of manufacturing places don't sit there, a lot of them anymore, because the people to support the restaurants aren't there. So it's like, it is a big ball of worms. I thought it was funny that they threw taxes at it and thought that might, you know, that this is going to help. But I think it's good to think about.
It's cool. I say just let it happen. And I mean, if we have to fire half the federal government, I feel like that's probably a good thing anyway. So
we're supposed to do that every 4 years, right?
Yeah, we're supposed to. Yeah, that's another show. We're gonna have that show after about a couple months from now. Then we're gonna have a show about that. Right now, no one's talking about that, nor do I want to be the one that talks about that. However,
I can't ignore the inevitable.
Yeah. No, but I think taxing isn't the right way. Let me.
I don't think so either.
I don't think taxing is the right way. I think companies responsibly deploying robotics in areas to augment people and to raise up and upskill is the key. And when I say upskill, I don't just mean change their jobs. I mean, literally upskilling what they're physically doing with the robots in many cases. Yeah. So, because a lot of this is augmenting people.
I'd like to see more of a benefit to that than a tax for the,
I agree.
I agree with that. And I don't pretend to be an economist or understand all the second and third aspects of everything that could happen, but it seems more beneficial to, why not benefit the company that does try to be more human, but let's not tax the ones that, I mean, yeah, because that money's going to go to nefarious purposes anyway. So,
yeah. And like you said, Travis, it's never going one to one. It's not that just doesn't happen. So I would agree with you. And I think this is a good segue because I want to keep us on time here. So if you were paying attention, they actually striked, if I'm not mistaken. So
3 days, I think.
3 days. Yeah. So the U.S. port strike ends, but clearing long ship queues will take time. And actually, I think I shared this with the group previously, that there was basically the longshoremen, which are the dock workers that offload so much of the goods that we need to be a thriving country, to be honest.
There's no train car to China. I don't know if you all knew that, but
on the East Coast, not the West Coast, on the East Coast, the International Longshoremen's Association, the workers' union, they went on strike for 3 days. And there was some interesting things in there. There was a pay discrepancy between the East Coast dock workers and the West Coast dock workers, and they wanted to shore that up. So they came to a temporary agreement, but there was a couple of other things that they did not agree upon that will still be a part of a longer term deal that they're going to have to talk about. So one was wages and kind of right sizing that, which I think they got taken care of. And I think was a good thing. Something that I wanted to bring to us that kind of plays into what we're all talking about is a lot of what the dock workers are concerned about is automation and the, instituting cranes, automated machinery on the docks themselves. And they haven't solved that yet. So I thought it was a good time, given that, you know, most of us here have worked in the construction industry that's looking at the same problem, kind of like what we just talked about. And now you have your longshoremen looking at it as well. And I wanted to get sort of some feedback. So Travis, I'm kind of interested to see where, given what else we just talked about, how you feel about this and sort of its impacts.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting thing. It kind of goes back to the other article, like when you were talking about how do you determine what's a robot, what's automation. I was listening to a podcast earlier this week where they talked about the improvements that have already happened in the shipping industry. Like they used to just dump everything into a hold. And then they came along with the shipping container and things were like, you could stack them, you could use crane, you know. So I think it's really interesting that, or it's really important that we don't stifle the innovation. And I think the reason it is important is and it relates to the construction industry, because this is another one of those industries that is hurting for people. So you have to balance that out, right? I'm in support of union workers getting paid the wage that is fair to them. But they also have to understand, like, there's just less and less of them. So how do you balance that out? How do you factor in some automation that allows that augments the workforce to work at the level it needs with fewer people that are coming into that particular industry or trade.
It is a balance, right? And for me, what I was really worried about here, and if you heard, there was some strong language. I was actually trying to get the original article, but there was some strong language where the original debate was no, like it has to be put in there. There could be no automation. There can be none of this. And I think that's really detrimental. I think it's really detrimental in any industry, in any place to do that, given that to some of the points we've made, like you just don't know what's going to happen and what you're going to need. And to say no, I think is a really bad idea. I think what I would like to see personally is an oversight, like actually lean in as the union and say, listen, what we want is oversight over the implementation and selection of any automation or robotics and how it impacts the workforce that we have. Because then you're a partner in making decisions. Because Trent, to your point, like you're kind of pulling me on the other side. Like I'm the guy who always says, like, we always end up with more jobs than we did before. But quite frankly, that doesn't mean a lot to a person who experienced this.
How does that come down? I mean, it's...
So there's an opportunity here to not say no, but say, hey, here's the checks and the balances and the oversight that we want as a union to make sure you take great steps. Because that way also, let's say 2, 3, 4 years from now, something huge happens that we don't know and you need this. Now you have the opportunity to implement it in a way that helps your union. And I think that's what we can learn from it.
What I don't know about, and this is a little bit of ignorance, what I don't know about the Longshoremen Labor Union, I've never been a part of it. So I don't know what their like signatory rules are really but like I can speak from the mechanical and plumbing world where, you know, there's contractors that are signatory to the union and then there's contractors that aren't. So this is important to understand. I would imagine that business could be the same. I mean, maybe there could be a doc that doesn't hire union. I don't know. I mean, like, I don't know that world. So, I mean, you know, someone could correct me, but I think my point there would be, you've got to find where the bargaining chips are. And I mean, like technology and automation is happening. It's going to happen. And it's the only way that we can really scale the amount of work that's needed for the amount of people that are in this world. So like what the mechanical and plumbing world I can speak from has done is, you know, rather than like completely, and some may not do this, but you know, you look at like the Chicago pipe fitters, Travis, or those, like, rather than stifling the innovation, they've brought the training of the innovation into the department and said, my guys are going to accept this and they're going to be the best damn people at operating in this environment. And like, so they've doubled down on the, on that. And I think you have to kind of play that rather than saying there will be no automation and we want a 70% raise or whatever they were asking for. Like, I have to think that in that signatory environment, like, they're going to put themselves out of being relevant. Like, I just would fear to, like, why not double down on where it would matter? Like, okay, I understand you're going to do this automation. I understand you're going to, and these are all great things for humanity and efficiency and, but let's talk about what all these different technologies and things are so I can make sure that my guys are the best damn people fitted to come in and do that. And then, you know, then that, I think that's where you double down. I mean, I don't know.
I would agree. John, you're chomping at the bit over there. What do you got, man?
Please go.
I feel like I take it both what you're saying, Jeff, and what Trent was saying kind of a step further. So I always tell people, like, it's easy to figure out tech if you treat it like a worker, like an actual human. Well, if you treat this like a workforce, eventually, because other docs have already automated, the offloading of pallets is going to be done by an automation workforce. So if you want to control that work, you should control that workforce. And I think that no one's quite got that much to actually go ahead and say, nope, we'll automate it. it's our guys doing the work. It's our people doing the work. This is our culture doing it. We know the best way to automate. We have the best suit. You talk about why tech doesn't launch in an industry. They don't have the right subject matter experts, and they don't have buy-in from the people doing it. Well, the people do it, if they can bring their own tools, so to speak, technologically, maybe that's what we do. You know, this is not a small union. This is not like mom and pop. This massive. Is a huge union with massive number of people. If they would like to control automation, that might be something that's like a real move, because it's a workforce that is competitive with their workforce. There's no way around it. Like you can shade it, but it's two workforces competing for the same work. Maybe they should own it.
If all you're defending is like, which the age old practice of a business manager at a labor union was to defend labor hours, right? It was all about more hours through my pool, more money for my workers, more money for the entity. Like that was all the, but man, you know, if all you're doing is try to pad labor hours, like I got news for you managers out there that like this new workforce, this new generation is not interested in working 80 hour weeks, like the days of old. So, I mean, and look, that's not an insult to any generation. Like the generations past worked 80 hours a week. That's what they did for their family. Like, and I mean, and I'm not, that was 100% what they had to do in the moment. But if that's what you're after is securing labor hours in a pool of people that isn't growing, it doesn't seem sustainable.
The other thing I want to say is also, I also do understand that a lot of the strong language that came out during this is part of a negotiation. So to the longshoremen and anyone listening, if you do happen to know a longshoreman, we're not saying that necessarily that's what it was. We're going with what was said, but I also know that that's part of a negotiation.
And I'm ignorant to that agreement. So
we all are. So we're just saying this was a good opportunity for us to look at it. And John, I really love the idea of looking at it as a workforce, as a part of your workforce, and then managing that in such a way that you control it for the betterment, right? Because also the idea behind the union itself is the betterment of the workforce, the betterment of the system and the products themselves. And that's why they're so beneficial in so many cases. So to that point, like we don't know that strong language, what it was. So
when the crane was invented, they trained the workforce to operate the crane. They didn't say, well, we're going to lose that work, right? I mean,
welding, what else? I mean, come up with everything else, right?
Well, like, to be honest, man, newspapers did typeset up until the 70s because they had a strong typeset union. So like, this is not like out in, like, I have miners from Pittsburgh that are in my family. They stopped automation too. But I think there's something for us to learn on. I read through what they were talking about. And one of the things on the automation side that they pointed out that I agree is a harm and is a management issue is they're like, hey, if this thing's going to pop a pallet down every 2 seconds in front of me and I'm supposed to move every 2 seconds, that ain't healthy. Like there is a level at which automation causes a level of productivity that is, you know, pushing on a person or pulling from a person faster than they should be done, you know, should be forced to work.
Well, and I think that's what we were talking about earlier too, where I think construction actually has done a good job, whether locally at the businesses or local at the locals, is working into a human automation like environment. Like
they co-working.
They bring them in and say, yeah, co-working. We're thinking of using this, you know, whatever, 6-axis cutter. What do you think? How does this work into your workflow? What can, you know, what are the things, the pitfalls that we're not seeing? And they really do try to work together in those aspects.
It's like, well, is it stealing labor hours at the cutting machine, or is it funneling 8 more welders that you can train for the, you
correct.
Know, I mean,
correct.
There are other ways to look at this. So I think you gotta be a little open-minded, but I agree, you know, they're, you know, defending your way of life and things like that is all very important. So I don't want to downplay what people are doing to provide for their families and their future, but I don't think it's a zero sum game. I don't think you have to like shut the technology and the innovation out. I think that that's probably going to lead to your extinction. So maybe like we find a way where we can kind of like train on the new stuff and make it work for everybody.
I think you just mic dropped us, Trent, because that is exactly the key component. That's why you can't just turn blind eye or stick your head in it or say no, because eventually it will happen. And how much better if it's done with a humanistic forethought. So Listen, guys, this was so much fun. We could go on for hours, but I'm trying to keep these episodes at a minimum. So thanks to the three dorks for joining me today, Travis, Trent, and Jonathan. It has been awesome. We're going to break the fourth law here. I think there's a fourth law in podcasting. I don't know if it exists, but if you'd like to hear more and you'd like to hear us rant, then you might want to check out the latest Dorkcast, because we're going to move on over to that room and have just a little bit more fun, where yours truly doesn't have to sit at the microphone and control, well, not control, but move it around between these three. So thanks, guys, for joining us today.